Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we'll speak with Amanda Marcotte, regular guest on this show, about her new book, Troll Nation. Then we'll be joined by Robin Panacchia. Robin is a contributor to Wonkette, and she follows these weird incel groups on a regular basis for Wonkette. And they have a feature called This Week in Garbage Men. And she'll talk to us about the incel rebellion and the truly bizarre debate that we've had this week about whether we should take their grievances, these wretched, murderous, misogynists, whether we should take their grievances seriously. Finally, we'll be joined by Bruce Bartlett. Bruce was a former Reagan official. He became a conservative apostate. And he has put together a little study about how this idea that white people face racial discrimination, but specifically more racial discrimination than other groups, may have predicted support for Donald Trump. But first, I just want to point out that this week we appear to have hit peak Scott Pruitt. Scott Pruitt, as you know, is the EPA administrator, very corrupt guy. We know Pruitt likes to travel first class, surrounded by bodyguards on taxpayers' dime. And this week, the Washington Post reported, and I quote, that after taking office last year, Pruitt drew up a list of at least a dozen countries he hoped to visit and urged aides to help him find official reasons to travel. Then he, quote, enlisted well-connected friends and political allies to help make the trips possible. This is pretty blatant. It was also reported by Brendan Fisher that it appears that Pruitt got reimbursed for the same expenses from his campaign account and from Oklahoma taxpayers. This is before he went to Washington, became EPA chief. And according to Fisher, he either violated campaign finance law by converting donations to personal use, or he violated ethics law by pocketing taxpayer money. Now, there's more. Reuters reported that Pruitt's EPA, and I quote, granted a financial hardship waiver to an oil refinery owned by billionaire Carl Icahn. Now, you may remember that Icahn took this job, and nobody knew what the job was, really, as an advisor to Trump last year. And then he quit when people started saying, hey, he took this gig with one goal in mind, eliminating biofuel requirements that were hurting his refinery's bottom lines. So, but just to understand how brazen this move is, you need to understand that this happened while Icahn is currently under investigation by the Justice Department for his role in influencing biofuels policy as Trump's advisor. And this kind of corruption is nothing new for Pruitt. Hiroki Tabushi and Steve Ader reported this week for the New York Times that, you know, we've heard about Pruitt having this apartment rental. He rented this condominium last year from a lobbyist with business before his agency. But that New York Times report noted that when he was in Oklahoma, when he was a state senator in Oklahoma, he, quote, bought a home in the state capitol with a registered lobbyist who was pushing for changes to the state's workers' compensation rules, changes that Mr. Pruitt championed in the legislature, end quote. And here is the cherry on the top, perhaps. Elena Plott at The Atlantic reported that a Pruitt press aide, guy named Michael Aboud, was so desperate to take the heat off of his sleazy-ass boss that he shopped a damaging story about Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke around to multiple news outlets. And the funny thing is he wanted reporters to tell a story about how Zinke's staffers were leaking damaging info about Pruitt. So it was a peak grifter this week, and actually, I think peak grift may be a myth, because with this regime, the grifting appears to be like a renewable resource. Anyway, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back. Welcome back to the show. I remain Joshua Holland. You know, I realize that we've spent so much time, we've devoted so many segments on the show to trying to explain how we got here, how we got to this kind of moment of madness. And I think it's a desperate attempt on my part to make sense of things that just don't make any sense at all. This week we have two different segments on that. And the first is with Amanda Marcotte. I'm always happy to have Amanda on the show. She is a columnist for Salon. She's also the author of a hard-hitting new book titled Troll Nation, How the Right Became Trump-Worshipping Monsters Set on Rat, Effing Liberals America, and Truth Itself. Amanda, as you may know, is not someone who pulls her punches. Amanda, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio, and congrats on the new book.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
All of the New York Times best-selling nonfiction books this year have been about Marshall Twito, so that's a good sign. And regular listeners know that since I did promo for my book and learned that interviewers will often pretend to have read it when they clearly didn't, I have this full disclosure policy. And although I read most of the books we discuss on the show, I got Amanda's on Wednesday. We are taping Friday, and I haven't read it. I started it, but Amanda, you're going to have to do the heavy lifting here. I'm sorry about that. And I'm totally going to read it. It's actually literally on my bedstand. So what is your thesis?
So the thesis is pretty straightforward. I believe that in the past few decades and increasingly in the past few years, conservatives have lost the moral, political, rational argument on many fronts, right? And rather than conceding defeat, they have instead become a movement of what I would call nihilism, really, and vengeance. that being unable to make rational, reality-based arguments for what they believe, they instead have turned all their political energies towards destroying and punishing liberals for being right.
It's owning the liberals, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it is. And this idea of online trolls, I mean, that is a specific mentality, isn't it?
Yeah, but and it's interesting. A lot of people who haven't read the book have come at me and thought that it was a book only about online trolls. But actually, my thesis is that the kind of thinking and thought process and mentality that drives online trolling also drives the Republican Party writ large, especially the voters. Like, they may not be online trolls, but the way they think, the way like Fox News operates, the way that people are even voting these days, the way politicians are campaigning, is like the same as online trolling. They are using the same tactics. They have the same goals.
Now, but let's dig into that a little bit, because I think that there is a style that is very much born of the internet, born of like 4chan chat boards. It's the whole Pepe's memes and all of that stuff. And you see that certainly in conservative media writ large. Kevin Williamson is a great example of that, I think. But there is something specific about that kind of approach to political discourse. I remember listening to this NPR segment after the election. They interviewed this young woman who posted a ton of Nazi memes during the campaign. And she wasn't a Nazi per se, or I mean, that's what she claimed anyway. And I kind of believed her, right? She seemed really naive and young. And her thing is that she just did it for the triggering, you know. It's like, it struck me as so odd. I was like, this person is a Nazi just to rile up people. You know, it reminds me of Gamergate and all of that.
Yeah, and I'm sure that, I don't know if she was in her heart of hearts a Nazi, but I'm sure that she was a reactionary. She was a fascist sympathizer on some level. And I think that that's something that I see over and over again, and really kind of, I hope, comes out in this book, which is these folks do have bigoted beliefs and opinions. I'm not saying they don't. It's not all for the lulz at all. But what it is that they can't defend Nazism, fascism, racism, sexism, any ism you want to toss out. They can't defend it on its own terms. So instead, what they do is they try to sort of turn it into this trolling event. It's not about, I'm going to make a rational, you know, argument for fascism, which, you know, some people in the past have tried to do. Like,
yes.
But it's more, that's sort of the stance is, I'm going to be a fascist to trigger the libs. They're going to be a fascist because they want to be a fascist, but the way the sort of framework and the rhetoric that pushes fascism is trigger the libs.
So, I mean, if you think of this as yet another angle of like what got us to Trump, that Trump is a symptom of other social ills, racism and xenophobia, and yes, this kind of trolley mentality. Where do you date the beginning? I mean, is it Rush Limbaugh? Is it the rise of right-wing talk radio? Is it the rise of Fox? What is the where does this mentality originate, or did they just run out of solid arguments to make?
I mean, I think there's always been a strain of this in right-wing ideology. In fact, those Confederate statues that have become such a point of contention were put up as trolls, right? They were put up to troll black people that were asking for civil rights. I've answered this question a lot, and I hope it gets at it in the book, but like, I do think that the way things took a turn towards that being their only real goal in life did start in the 90s with Rush Limbaugh. And I mean, I think Rush initially kind of started backing, you know, a sort of Republican agenda, you know, what was that Promise to America or Vision for America that Newt Gingrich had? I don't remember what it was called.
It was the Contract with America, and then we called it the Contract on America.
Yeah, the Contract with America, yeah. So it's not like they didn't have ideas and they weren't trying to promote them back then, but if you listen to Rush Limbaugh's radio show in the 90s, you could see this rhetorical strategy forming, which is most of the show was about how liberals are stupid, bad people, and that stomping on them at all costs is a is a life's mission and a political ideology unto its own. And the thing is, you know, where I grew up, you know, a lot of people are really Republican, they're really conservative. But it wasn't until the 90s that I started hearing people talk about liberals in these dripping, condescending, hateful tones that now have become so ubiquitous, it's hard to remember a time before that that was true.
Amanda is from Texas, and she's also from the part of Texas I don't like.
Oh, well, I mean, the mountainous deserts, you know, it's beautiful.
It's kind of scary. That, well, aren't you, you're from the eastern kind of I-10 corridor, right?
I am from West Texas, actually, originally.
So I'm totally wrong. Yeah. Never mind.
No, eastern I-10 corridor is legit scary.
That's the part that I hate. That's absolutely, it's basically Alabama.
Yeah, no, I'm from...
a swampier Alabama. I'm sorry, I had that wrong. I thought that you were from... like Vidor or something like that.
Oh, thank the Lord. I'm from the border with Mexico, that area.
Okay. No, I like that part of Texas, actually.
Yeah.
Except for the intrusive, like, border patrol stops 25, 50 miles from the border, where I'm like, what the hell is going on here? That's neither here nor there. Let me ask you this. Mainstream reporting has various norms for fairness, you know, telling both sides, this is obviously a well-worn territory. Is that part of the problem? Is the media incapable of calling out this kind of trolling behavior because they have an institutional norm toward taking arguments seriously or assuming that they're made in good faith?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I think that we would... It is literally part of the trolling mentality of the right, is that a long time ago they realized that they could troll the media endlessly with these feigned outrages, right? I mean, the latest example as we're speaking is the whole thing over the Washington Correspondents' Dinner and Michelle Wolf's performance there. No one was actually mad about that, but they knew that they could kind of play the refs and the right knew and act all offended and outraged, and that would be taken seriously, and they could drive the conversation in what was functionally just a trolling style. You know, none of this was real. All of it was about performance. All of it was about culture war. All of it was about triggering the libs.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking to Amanda Marcotte about her new book. It's called How Troll Nation, How the Right Became Trump-Worshipping Monsters Set on Rat-Effing Liberals, America, and Truth Itself. So how do we combat this, or is it something that we can combat? How do we make the mainstream press understand that these are not arguments that are serious and made in good faith, but their purpose is to troll and steer the discourse to places where, you know, that have an ideological unideologically friendly territory for them?
I want to congratulate you for being the first person to frame this question as how to get the media to understand. Most people interview me want to know how to get these trolls to stop being trolls.
That's not going to happen. I try to be realistic about this world, and that is not going to happen.
As far as the mainstream media, I am slightly more optimistic that there's an avenue in here, which is that their own profession is under peril from this, right? I have a whole chapter in the book about this, and Donald Trump, he has been, and it's not, again, none of this starts with Donald Trump. Rush Limbaugh made the mainstream media the enemy of the people in the 90s. It goes back even to the 50s. Like, this notion that the mainstream media is not conservative, thus must be liberal, and therefore is the liberal biased media, has gone back a long time. Yes. So they've been pressured by that for decades, and they've been buckling. But I think and hope that with Donald Trump being so out there, with the contradictions between, you know, these right-wing claims to believe in free speech and their actual attempts to oppress freedom of the press, you know, to suppress freedom of the press, with the actual threats against journalists being made, I hope that the mainstream media starts to realize that the dignity of their profession is under assault, but also like their ability to do their job may soon be under assault. Like they've been kowtowing to these bullies for a long time in a really undignified manner. But I think that, you know, with Trump implying that he's going to go after, for instance, Amazon's profit margins in order to, because he thinks he's going to shut down the Washington Post, like, I hope journalists realize that this is like serious and that they can't pretend not to see what I think they obviously see, which is this is not a balanced fight between two sides that are equal in their sort of moral outlook.
You know, I am, I guess the kind of silver lining that I hope for, and you see this again and again, is exactly what you're talking about. The Trump's penchant for turning subtext into text, saying the quiet parts out loud, is so blatant and in your face that it is, one hopes, causing people to re-examine. But I'll tell you something. I the thing that worries me, you see this with like New York Times editors right now, the way that they interact with people on social media when they get any criticism, is I don't see that they're distinguishing between criticism from people who want the New York Times to die a slow, painful death and good faith criticism from people who want it to be a better institution. It seems like they put up their hackles equally against both kinds of criticism. And this is a concern. It certainly should be the case that Trump's erratic, rambling nonsense, constant erratic, rambling nonsense, the demagoguery, the endless demagoguery, just this, the madness surrounding this White House would open some eyes, but I just don't know.
Yeah, I would even go a step further than you, and I would say that the New York Times especially, I mean, I think the Washington Post has been behaving a lot better, like their people, but the New York Times especially seems to get their hackles up even higher from good faith criticism from liberals than being told to die in a fire by conservatives. They just treat that as like wallpaper and noise. And then they bend over, well, no, actually they don't. They bend over backwards to try and reassure conservatives that they're not biased. And when liberals are like, but by doing that, you're creating a de facto bias towards the right, which is true. Then all of a sudden they just like flip out on you. And it's just so frustrating because it's like, maybe the solution I think is obvious to you and it's obvious to me, which is they just need to be biased towards the truth and just let people say what they're going to say, you know?
Yeah. No, I mean, that is exactly right. And I think it's exactly what you said, that they've had this kind of constant background hum of criticism from the right for 60, 70 years, and they've become inured to it. So that's just kind of, you know, par for the course. And then when they get good faith criticism from liberals who want them to be better reporters, it's like that is something that they take really personally. And it's a problem. Amanda, I believe we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you. I really appreciate it too.
Folks, Amanda's book, again, is called Troll Nation, How the Right Became Trump-Worshipping Monster Set on Rat, Effing Liberals, America, and Truth Itself. We're going to take a quick break and then dive down an even grosser rabbit hole and talk about incels and the incel rebellion. It's, ugh, what a sick moment we live in. Folks, stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and come right back. Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm still Joshua Holland. You know, I did not want to do this segment this week. I was hesitant to give such stupid arguments, such ridiculous arguments as the one that we're going to talk about, credibility or more weight than they deserve. But here's the thing about these murderous incels and the attempt to empathize with them and to see things from their twisted perspective. The reason that I feel like we can't ignore it, the only reason, is because occasionally they go out and kill a bunch of people. So this is something that I would prefer to ignore, but I don't think we can. So my next guest is Robin Panacchia. She's a writer, a freelance writer, a contributor to Wonkette. She wrote a piece on Wonkette about Ross Douth. Robin, how do you pronounce his last name?
I say Douthat, or actually, I mean, in my mind, I say douchebag, but Douthat, yeah. I believe.
Douthat, okay. So Ross Douthat, the New York Times columnist, entertained this idea of, like, redistributing sex to these creepy incels. Anyway, Robin Panacchia covers these people on a regular basis. She has a regular column or feature, I guess you'd call it, a post called Horrible Men?
The Week in Garbage Men.
The Week in Garbage Men. Anyway, Robin, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thank you for having me.
So, okay, let me ask you this. For listeners who are fortunate enough that they didn't pay attention to this little bizarre debate that we had this week, just go over what the argument is that was made by first this kind of crackpot libertarian professor, economist at George Mason University, and then Ross Douthat took it up in the pages of the New York Times.
Well, basically, after Alex Manassian went and ran over a bunch of people in Toronto because he couldn't get laid, rather than saying, oh, hey, this person is extremely messed up, they went to the well of, oh, gosh, these men are sad that they can't get laid. They're so sad that they're murdering people. What can we do to help? Let's redistribute sex to them in some way so that they don't murder people, which is ridiculous because if you're a person who's like, you know, the
if
kind
you're
of person
murderer,
who's going to go, yeah, like you're not going to be like that's not actually going to make you not a murderer.
You know, here's the thing, like the Son of Sam, a dog told him to kill people, right?
Yeah.
David Chapman, who shot John Lennon, he shot John Lennon because John Lennon said that he was more popular than God. David Hinckley shot Ronald Reagan.
Jodie Foster.
To win over Jodie Foster's love. We don't treat these things as serious claims. Nobody ever thinks, well, maybe we should have redistributed some Jodie Foster to David Chapman.
Patently
ridiculous.
Which is why I made the comment, which is like, you know, why my thing was about, you know, you're not going to say, oh, people should donate their bodies to cannibals because cannibals want human flesh. They don't want human flesh. They want power. They want control. They want, like, to hurt people. Like, that's not their actual goal.
Yes.
And these people, if they were involved in relationships with women, those women would be in trouble because they're psychotic.
Yes, exactly.
You know,
they're psychotic misogynists.
I think, well, Douthat specifically was trying to also use it as a cudgel to attack feminists and the left for wanting to treat sex workers as human beings. Like, that was actually part of his, you know, when he explained later, he was like, actually, what I want to explain to you all is that I was, you know, a modest proposaling this because it's so ridiculous that the left thinks that sex workers should be treated with dignity, that this is the obvious outcome, that we use that somehow to distribute sex to men who would murder women for not because they can't get laid.
I mean, don't we feel like this is just embarrassingly stupid, the whole thing. But here's where I will disagree with you. I don't think we should even say that it's because they don't get laid. All right? I mean,
the bottom line is these are
hateful misogynists.
Don't hurt women no matter what situation they're in. Like, whether it's because of that or it's because...
Yeah. Well, look, I'm also loath to point this out, but we've had three mass murdering incels in this incel rebellion. Incel, by the way, stands for involuntary celibate. And there is this whole language among these freaks on these internet comment boards. They've developed a rather elaborate ideology with like guys named Chad, and their idealized woman is Stacy, and the Stacys are promiscuous, but only with the Chads. Then the rest of the male population is deprived of Stacy's love or whatever. But the bottom line is that, all three of these psycho killers who went off and murdered people were relatively decent looking young guys. I think we need to get away from the idea that they are killing people because they can't get laid. They're killing people because they hate women and they're part of this like radical murder cult. I mean, it's beyond crazy. Now, to be fair, and I don't want to be fair, and we shouldn't be fair, because these is our ridiculous arguments we're dealing with. The economist that began this, Robin, what is his name? Do you remember?
Hansen.
Robin Hansen, who is this like glib libertarian troll at George Mason University. He has previously written about how cuckolding, how women cheating on men is worse than rape, but not violent rape, gentle rape. He's a freak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To be more fair than we should be with this guy, he said, I'm not talking about forcing women to sleep with these incels. I'm talking about we should be able to come up with something that might include prostitutes or sex bots. Now,
but here's the thing. I don't think that we should like say, oh, let's foist these guys onto sex workers, and that's not going to cure them anyway.
Why
and
won't that cure them?
They also hate sex workers, and they don't
exactly
want
right.
sex bots because what they want is to control someone.
Well, what they
like
want
they
is
want
to control Stacy, right? So they the fundamental, and again, I'm sorry to even take this argument seriously, but the fundamental flaw is that they have no interest in sex workers or sex robots. The only interest they have in sex robots is that they think that at some point sex robots are going to make women superfluous and then they will have power again. So like the idea of giving them some sort of sexual gratification to calm them down is just analytically bereft. It just fails to understand that we are dealing with radicalized, misogynistic nut jobs, and there is no rational motive behind their bloodletting. Robin, I am sorry to even bother you with this crap.
Okay.
We are about out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
All right. You have a great day.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then we'll be right back with Bruce Bartlett.
Her love, her love. Oh, no, oh, scientists can find. All day long, all night long, we couldn't find the Syria home. All day long, all night long, no formula home, no Syria home. Early home, early home, it's like the city of Atlantis. Scientists cannot find it. Men like Sherlock Holmes, Oh man, like Humphrey Bogart. Judge really know. Even the ape couldn't find her love. Her love. It's just like the lost city of Atlantis. No scientist can find it.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Joshua Holland. I'm almost embarrassed that I hadn't previously had my next guest on the show. Bruce Bartlett is a historian. He's the author of a number of books. Most recently, The Truth Matters, A Citizen's Guide to Separating Facts from Lies and Stopping Fake News in Its Tracks. Bruce served in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations and has become an important voice for understanding how the modern conservative movement has kind of gone off the rails. Bruce Bartlett, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Happy to be here.
I'm really happy to have you on the show. Bruce sent me a link to an unpublished study he put together that links Trumpism with the idea of reverse racism, the idea that white people are the victims of discrimination, more so than other groups. And I want to put this into the larger context of how we got to this point. This is to this point of Trumpism. This is the second segment this week that touches on this theme. At this point, there's basically a mountain of empirical evidence that shows that while the racial resentment that kind of propelled Trump to victory is inextricably connected to economic anxiety, it was not economic anxiety itself that caused people to support Trump. Political scientist John Sides told me on this show, and I quote, "A really good predictor of whether you supported Trump in the Republican primary wasn't so much, are you worried about losing your job, pure economic anxiety, as it was, do you think that whites lose out on jobs because they have to be given to minorities? If economic anxiety mattered, it was because it was bound up with concerns about my group status versus this other group's." So with that as context, and Bruce, I'm sorry to be long-winded about it, let's talk about this paper that you put together. What was your thesis, and what did you discover?
Well, I don't remember now what precisely what sparked my interest. I had observed that a lot of seemingly racist behavior by Trump and by some of his supporters wasn't racist in the conventional sense of, you know, I just hate black people because they're black or something like that. It's more that they have some unrealistic beliefs, unrealistic expectations, perhaps. And one of them is this seemingly ridiculous idea that white people are more discriminated against racially than black people. And in the course of just doing, you know, a casual amount of research on this, I discovered there was actually quite a large literature on this subject. There are, you know, good studies, poll data and things of that sort in which, you know, significantly large numbers of people, including black people, will say that, yes, white people are racially discriminated against. And this just kind of blew my mind. And so I just kept digging, you know, like pulling the thread on a sweater. And I was just amazed at how much has been published on this subject. And so my goal was really just to try to show people that this exists, that this phenomenon exists, and call their attention to the literature on the subject in you know, the highest level academic journals in the field of psychology and sociology and elsewhere, and just call it to their attention. So it was really more that I'm just trying to show people that this is a real phenomenon, so that they don't just say, oh, that's ridiculous, and move on.
I mean, you put it correctly just now when you said it's a ridiculous idea, and I don't think this needs to be said, but I'll say it anyway. You know, 44 out of 45 presidents, most of Congress, most of the people who sit on boards of major corporations, including media corporations, I should add, are white. How is this idea sustainable? And would you connect this sense of victimization to the conservative media echo chamber that you have long criticized?
Well, there's no question about that. I didn't mention it in this article, but because he wasn't really as prominent at the time, but Tucker Carlson on Fox has a segment almost every night about some way in which a white person was harmed by a black person, and try to feed this idea that black people are out to get white people. And of course, a lot of this harkens back to, you know, the now almost 50-year-old concept of affirmative action, which really is not very operational these days. But at one time, there were significant efforts being made to try to compensate for historical discrimination by giving, you know, minorities a little bit of a boost in various ways that I think got converted by its enemies into a rigid quota, so that you know, you had to give a certain number of jobs to black people, whether they were competent for the job or not. And a lot of white people, I think, to this day believe that they lost jobs, lost acceptances to universities and things of that sort to affirmative action. And I don't think it's true, or certainly not true in very large numbers, but it gives people an excuse for their own failures that doesn't, you know, reflect on themselves.
Yeah, so much for taking personal responsibility. Affirmative action is what I immediately thought of when I read your paper. I also thought, and I wonder what you think of this, is it related to the organization of evangelical Christians as a key faction within the Republican coalition? And I ask that because they have long tended to embrace the idea that Christians are a hated and discriminated against minority, even though 71% of Americans identify as Christians, according to Pew.
I think there's something to that. But one of the things that fascinated me in the course of my research, I don't remember how much of it got into this paper, but I was doing some research on the Civil War. And one of the things that I discovered is that when Southerners, slave owners, came under attack by Northern abolitionists, the argument was very, very much in religious terms. That is, the Northern abolitionists opposed slavery for religious reasons, and the Southerners responded with an interesting religious argument of their own, which is that the Bible basically condones slavery. And in fact, it does. There are a great many passages that are easy to find in both the Old Testament and the New Testament, basically saying slavery is just, you know, an ordinary phenomenon of life. It's neither good nor bad nor anything else. And there's even some stuff that, you know, on the kookier fringes that argue that black people are cursed by God. They bear the curse of Ham or the curse of Cain or something like that. I don't honestly understand it. And so this, but the only way you could sustain this argument that the Bible supports slavery is by taking a very literal reading of the Bible. So the need to defend slavery led Southern Protestants into biblical fundamentalism, biblical literalism, that led very naturally to what we now call evangelicalism. And so one of the things that happened during the war is you had the Southern branches of national Protestant denominations, such as the Baptists, split into Southern and Northern factions because the Southern one supported slavery. And these this still exists to the present day. And so you have this evangelical phenomenon is very, very strong in the states of the former Confederacy, and I believe its roots date back to this phenomenon.
That is fascinating. I had not connected those threads, but now that you mention it, I mean, Manifest Destiny was inherently a religious argument. Bruce, let me step back for a moment, because I can't have you on the show without just asking you a question or two about your own development into a conservative apostate.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Can you say that? Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
And I don't know exactly when you began calling out your fellow conservatives for abandoning factual debate and kind of blowing up institutional norms. My sense is that it was during the George W. Bush administration. Is that right?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it happened almost literally on a specific day. It was November 22nd or 23rd, I forget, 2003. Now, you may be familiar with a program called Medicare Part D, which pays for prescription drugs for the elderly, for people on Medicare. And
yes.
Previously, Medicare had not paid for prescription drugs. It only paid for doctor's visits and hospitals. Now, there was a perfectly good argument for why Medicare should cover prescription drugs. But the problem was that the plan that the Republicans came up with had no financing. They just put $400 billion over 10 years onto the national credit card. Now, at the time, you know, I was working for a conservative think tank. I'd been, you know, a good soldier in the conservative movement for quite a few years, specializing in economic issues, tax and budget in particular. And I thought that what we needed to be doing was cutting entitlement programs, not making them bigger. And so I was just horrified when my party, the Republican Party, just threw everything that I thought it believed in about fiscal policy into the toilet, really for one purpose, and that was to buy the votes of the elderly, literally. And it worked very well. The elderly are very strongly supportive of the Republican Party. For many, many decades, they had been the backbone of the Democratic coalition. They had supported the creation of Medicare, the creation of Social Security, and they were grateful to the Democratic Party for those programs. But now, they've switched over to being Republican, and I've yet to read a good analysis of the elderly doing this, but certainly Medicare Part D had a great deal to do with this. And anyway, I was writing a syndicated column at the time, and I started writing things critical of this legislation, and it kind of led me to have a kind of open my eyes about other things that Bush and the Republican Party were doing that I had known about and had misgivings about, but had chosen not to make an issue of because, you know, party loyalty, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
So the glass, in a sense, went from being half full to being half empty. And so I started regularly criticizing Bush, criticizing Republicans on conservative grounds. That's the thing that's very important to understand. I was criticizing Bush over things like, you know, steel tariffs and various other things that, you know, that were against conservative ideology. Well, anyway, this got me into a lot of trouble with the organization I worked for, and they told me to stop doing this. So what I did is I decided, well, I'm going to write a book about this. And I wrote one, and it was published. It was called Imposter, How George W. Bush Bankrupted America and Betrayed the Reagan Legacy. The entire thesis of the book, the entire book, is about how Bush, you know, failed the conservative test. He was not, he did not govern as a conservative. And all the people I quoted in the book were good conservatives. Nevertheless, this book got me fired from my job and essentially lost me every friend that I had in Washington, because there's tremendous pressure for conformity among the conservative movement, and they punish apostates just as thoroughly as the Amish do, you know. And as you know, the Amish will shun you right. and never speak to you again, even if you're a blood relative, if you commit some sin against the church. And this is what happened to me. And so I think, frankly, I was an example that was put out there so that others who felt the same way would not stray from the mother party or whatever you want to call it. And you know, once completely unmoored from, you know, my friends and the institutions and organizations that I had been affiliated with, you know, it became easier and easier to think for myself about various issues, and I began rethinking a lot of issues. And I still pretty much consider myself a classical conservative of the type that no longer exists. I think the conservative movement today is the opposite of what of its historical conception, you know, by, you know, people like Burke. And so I, you know, I've tried to articulate a philosophy in various books and articles, but nobody on the right pays any attention to them. And sadly, very few people on the left.
I think you underestimate how popular you've become on the left.
All I know is how many times I ever get asked to write for, say, The Nation, which is zero.
Maybe I can do something about that. When I look back on Medicare Part D, it seems fiscally conservative compared to what Republicans have done under Trump.
He's an order of magnitude off the scale.
It's something completely different. I mean, it really is remarkable. And I'm not a deficit hawk like you, but I'm even shocked by the profligate spending and tax cuts, unpaid for tax cuts, blowing these huge deficits up. Did you see this political moment coming in advance? And I don't mean Trumpism specifically, but the unmooring of partisanship, Republican partisanship, from traditional conservative ideologies, the increasing use of racial dog whistles, etc. Did you see the writing on the wall?
Well, I can't say I saw it in advance, but I did see it in real time, I think quicker than other people did. I mean, very few people even to this day will acknowledge you know, the truth you just spoke. But I did write another paper you can find on that same website where my reverse racism paper is, about Fox News, because I think that that changed the political dynamics in this country very, very fundamentally, because conservatives now could get, you know, an unadulterated conservative message 24/7, and they had never had that before. And the Fox model has moved further and further to the right, becoming more and more populist, less and less hinged to and attached to any concept of journalistic ethics, and it's become what I call self-brainwashing. I mean, it would be an extraordinarily rare situation if you talked to somebody, especially somebody, you know, up in years, 50s, 60s, 70s, who doesn't get virtually all their news from Fox, and that this is the source of their support for Trump, support for conservative candidates, conservative ideas. It's the essential transmission mechanism. And one of the things that they do that I don't think gets enough credit, even from, you know, sophisticated journalistic analysts, is they mainstream and normalize a lot of really nutty crackpot stuff. And
yes.
So things like Obama's birth certificate, which I think Obama himself dismissed as a joke for a long time. And people on the left, I think to this day, still have trouble believing that this idea was entertained seriously. But, you know, I Trump, you know, to his credit, saw that this was something he could latch on to give himself credibility among the furthest right element of the Republican coalition. It was a way of saying, I'm sort of a racist, without using the N-word or being too explicit about it. And people pick up on code words and attitudes and terminology to try to decide, is this my guy or is he my enemy? And he really recognized, unconsciously or not, that the growth of the far right element in the Republican coalition had grown sufficiently to where it reached a threshold where you could win a divided primary just with those votes. And you had, you know, what, how many, 13 other people running, all dividing up the mainstream Republican coalition into 13 different parts. And Trump, you know, I mean, with retrospect, won very, very easily, and still really hasn't been challenged because the mainstream, you know, hates this stuff. But they're gutless. They don't have any courage whatsoever because they are just scared shitless of this, of the base. And you know, there's an old saying in Washington that Republicans are scared of their base and Democrats hate theirs.
Yeah. Bruce Bartlett, I think that is one of the clearest analyses I've heard to date. We are about out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. And I hope we can get you on the show more often.
Okay.
I also want to thank Amanda Marcotte and Robin Panacchia. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show at iTunes or Podbean, SoundCloud, or wherever else you can find it. You can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. I'd also like to thank the good folks at Hullabaloo and Smirking Chimp and Crooks and Liars for letting me host the show at their respective joints. Of course, I would like to thank all of you excellent people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.